was a regular.
It's like frozen.
Look it up and see. Are you ready?
Sure.
Put me on top. Call to order.
Me and Rob know.
The House Committee on Health Care for this fabulous first day of March. To let March roar in like a lion in our committee.
What is wrong with this computer?
No other work. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2432. Madam Administrator, what are we having?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2432 directs the Health Licensing Office to issue a license to practice art therapy to a qualified art therapist. It specifies the license qualification and requires the licensed art therapist to comply with the office adopted rules. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. Mr. Chair, we have a dash four amendments. The dash four amendments allows trained, certified, and licensed persons who are not art therapists to use art therapy in the person's practice. It also those individuals are supervised study of art therapy. I believe that's it. There's no revenue impact on the dash fours. There is a fiscal statement on the dash fours. LFO did clarify that they do not require it in ways and means. This is funded by other funds, and it's a minimal expenditure of $13,000.
Okay.
The other co-chair is harassing the witness.
Huh?
The other co-chair is harassing the witness.
No, there's no witness there. I don't see any witness.
No, in fact, I'm ready for a
motion. All right, here you go, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair Greenleg, I would like to move to adopt the dash four amendments dated February 13th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves we adopt the dash four amendments to House Bill 2432. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moves.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2432 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2432 to the floor. As amended with a new pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the bill? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Bueller.
Aye.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Excuse.
Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pass.
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Hayes. Aye.
Chair well, the motion carries. Representative Parrish will carry the bill on the floor. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2432 and open the work session on House Bill 2675. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2675 adds the integration of oral health in the development of the community health improvement plans that are adopted by the coordinated care organizations and the community advisory councils. This bill is ready to go. There are no amendments.
Oral health and mental health.
Correct. And physical.
Yeah, the integration.
Correct.
Okay.
No amendment, Mr. Chair. There's no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the bill.
Do I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2675 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2675 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Bueller.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Hanson.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Noakes.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Greenleg.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden will carry it on the floor. Can I have a motion to suspend the rules?
I was just going to ask. Yes. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that the committee suspend our rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Alonzo Leon to vote on House Bill 2432.
Representative Noakes moves the rules be suspended to allow Representative Alonzo Leon to cast a vote on House Bill 2432. Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Alonzo Leon?
Yes.
Yes. She votes. She votes yes. Please record that. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill, I think I did already, 2675, but if not, it's closed for good now. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on hospital community benefit, hospital community benefits. I think I will kick it off, but I think I'll kick it off from here, if I may, colleagues. I think 6 years ago, we passed a bill on hospital community benefit defining what could or could not be included in the report on the hospital community benefit. This bill brings us up to a more modern place on that. This is a bill in Revenue Committee, not in this committee. We thought it would be useful to have a hearing here. I think there'll be a hearing Monday, if those of you are interested, in Revenue Committee. I was stimulated to work on this bill when I looked at the community benefit report from a hospital in my district, which reported in 1 year 8% of their revenue spent on community benefit, but 6% of that 8% was spent on a combination of underpayment for Medicare and underpayment for Medicaid, and only 2% was spent on the rest of what we've defined as community benefit, which is education, research, and charitable care. The bill that I have in revenue now would tinker with that. I've been working with the Hospital Association very closely to try and come up with a compromise bill, which I think we're very close to getting. We'll have an amendment in the next week or so in the Revenue Committee. But I thought it would be useful to get some discussion in this committee because it's very clearly falls in our wheelhouse. We have a panel. And Administrator, would you call the panel and talk to us about the bill?
We'll start out with Kirsten Isaacs. She's going to start. And then Jesse Beeson will follow her. And then he wants to come by himself.
Okay, great.
I think.
So. We could have had, by the way, dozens of witnesses. I've asked folks to hold it to a few to raise the issues that we need to raise, and then we can switch the debate over to the Revenue Committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Isaacson. I'm a healthcare researcher for SEIU Local 49. And I'm just going to provide a brief overview of the hospital industry and how it has changed over time. There we go. Okay, so hospitals were originally the last resort health, served as last resort health care for the poor and sometimes even shelter, because most folks who had of means were treated by doctors in their home. And in recognition of this, federal exemption was originally granted. And then as time progressed, we had the advent of Medicaid and Medicare introducing new payment streams to hospitals. And then finally, we come to our present day where hospitals serve all classes of people and receive payment for most of them, although not all. And so we have a situation where hospitals at one point were in some ways 100% charitable in how they were spending their money or dedicating their revenues. And to today, where we have, on average, the Oregon Hospital spending 1.8% of its revenues in charity care. Yet the full tax exemption remains the same. And the value of this exemption is significant. It was estimated in 2011 to be worth $24.6 billion nationwide. And it leads us to our current tax situation or exemption situation where instead of talking about just about charity care, we talk about community benefits. So what are these community benefits? The chart on the right here, the pie chart, you can see that Oregon tracks 11 different categories of community benefits right now. And you can note that the large orange section is Medicaid and the large blue section in the pie chart is Medicare. Together, they count for over 70% of hospital community benefit spending in our state. But that hasn't always been the case. If you look at the bar chart on the left, comparing 2015 to 2010, you can see that the level of community benefit spending as a percentage of overall revenues has remained flat, but the component parts have changed. Charity care has declined precipitously. It's down by nearly 70%. And Medicaid, correspondingly, has increased as former charity care patients now have OHP. And so Medicare, I do want to highlight that Medicare is considered a community benefit in our state. It is the largest category of community benefit spending. But the federal government, the IRS, do not count Medicare, quote, underpayments or shortfalls as a community benefit. And the Medicare payment rate is set by a nonpartisan agency to cover the costs of an efficient hospital. But community benefits aren't the only part about our hospital or healthcare industry that is changing. We're seeing hospitals consolidating with other hospitals and also vertically integrating and taking over more aspects of the healthcare continuum. And sometimes, particularly as this relates to primary care clinics that formerly were maybe owned by a doctor's practice and for profit, as those clinics come under the umbrella of a nonprofit hospital association, sometimes that extends their nonprofit tax exemption with them. And other impacts of this consolidation among hospitals and across the care continuum is increased hospital market power. This has been linked to higher healthcare practices, and we will explore this more in our rate review testimony later. But all of this market consolidation, increased insurance rates, reduced charity care, increased Medicaid payments adds up to hospitals increasing their profits dramatically over recent years. In 2015, Oregon hospitals netted over $1 billion. And so we come to today where there are federal proposals to potentially repeal and replace healthcare or the Affordable Care Act. Regardless of what happens, we expect that healthcare in our state will continue to be unaffordable for most Oregonians. According to a 2016 poll conducted by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard Chan School, one in four adults in Oregon say that healthcare costs have caused serious financial problems for them as an individual or their family, one in four. And 45% of those folks report spending all or most of their personal savings to address that financial burden. And another 44% have been contacted by bill collectors. SEIU Local 49 did a study of bankruptcy filings last year in Lane County. We found that 72% of personal bankruptcy filings held some sort of medical debt. And of that debt, the majority was held by Oregon hospital systems. And from our experience, we know that hospital employees, just like other Oregonians, cannot afford their health care. Many are on high deductible or just plain expensive plans. Our members report avoiding or delaying care because of the financial costs that they think they will incur. And more often, if it's possible, they put themselves or what happens more often is they put their children on the Oregon health plan because it is a quality, affordable health plan.
Is this to the point of the bill we're talking about today?
I'm sorry, say that again?
I'm asking if what you're talking about now is specifically relevant to the community benefit question.
Yes, because we believe that the affordability of healthcare ties to what hospitals should invest in community benefit to alleviate that financial burden. And when we talk about our, well, for Local 49, when we think about our members being unable to afford their health care, a lot of that, they are actually qualifying for sometimes charity care or these programs that fall under community benefit of the hospitals. So when we think about expanding community benefit and what that is, its component parts, yes.
Can I ask a clarifying question really quick?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. So just to clarify.
Yeah.
They can't afford the insurance. The deductibles are too high. They're in debt from the hospitals, but they qualify for the charity care. I'm not quite wrapping my head around that.
Right. Thank you. Well, Chair Greenlick and Representative Heck, it's one person, obviously, you're correct, that one person can't occupy all those spaces at once. But when we look across our membership, we do have some people who are enrolled in OHP themselves, in which case they obviously can't afford their care. But we also have a fair number of members whose children are enrolled in OHP, but they themselves are on their employer's plan with the high deductible or high copays that are difficult to afford.
I'm still not certain how that relates to the question of community benefit.
Well,
theoretically, if they're in the hospital and need charity care, then
they're getting charity care.
And I understand there's a problem, the high cost of hospital care. We're going to get to that in the next slide, the next item. But I'm just not sure where you're going with this. So if would you try and get there?
Sure. Thank you. I'm actually towards the end of that slide and the end of my presentation. So I guess one of the points that I was going to make is that we know from our membership that there are a fair amount of enrollees on OHP who are employees of health systems. But unlike other industries who also have thousands of employees enrolled on OHP, hospitals receive a significant amount of funding from public, a majority of their funding is coming from public streams, and they're also exempt from many taxes. And so the Legislative Revenue Office released a report and did a presentation in the House Revenue Committee last week where they talked about the value of these tax exemptions for the 2015-16 year. And the largest category under charitable property tax exemptions was the hospital, addiction, and medical care category, which accounted for 64% of the lost tax revenues in that charitable exemption policy. It was by far the largest category. And looking specifically at hospitals, which you can see on this LOR chart here, 65% of the revenue loss from hospitals comes from hospitals doing less than 1.5% in charity care. And on the right, you can see for the top line, just six hospitals representing a combined revenue loss of $8.6 million. Provided less than 5% in community benefits. So we think there's kind of disparate dedication to charity and community benefits among hospitals, and this is coming at significant lost revenue.
Can I?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Is the 64% loss in revenue, are you talking about property tax, or are you talking about? Because these folks are paying a lot of tax revenue, so they bring in revenue on the tax side that they pay. So are you, I just want a clarification that you're talking about a property tax.
Yeah. Thank Chair you. Greenlick, Representative Heck, yes, this refers to property taxes only.
Thank you.
So in brief conclusion, As we look ahead, we think that clarifying expectations and definitions around charity care and community benefit will be helpful. And specifically, we think that the exclusion of Medicare shortfalls and aligning ourselves with the federal standard would be beneficial to our state. And we also think that that kind of clarifying our expectations could make it clear for all hospitals across the state, because some are doing as high as 35% of their revenue in community benefits, and others are doing as low as 1%, yet all are receiving this tax exemption.
Thank you. Thank you, Tessa. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you for the presentation. Clearly, there are some assumptions built into the presentation and the figures and hospital profits and all that. Would you say it would the hospitals would agree with those assumptions, or did you interact with them at all?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, no, I don't feel like I can speak to what they would say. I mean, much of our numbers are coming from the Oregon Health Authority, as reported by the hospitals.
We're going to hear from a hospital representative.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Beeson, I...
I'm ready.
Go for
you
it.
Are. All right. Good afternoon,
Chair.
I thought
you were leaving.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Beeson. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs at the Northwest Health Foundation. Thank you all for the chance to join you today. Today I'll be talking about the nexus between community benefit and social determinants of health. I want to start out by saying that from our founding board president, Senator Mark Hatfield, to our current board president, Vannetta Abdellatif, our foundation's commitment to advancing the health of the people of Oregon and everyone in our region has been steadfast. Since our beginning in 97, we've seen healthcare access expand to ensure that nearly everyone in Oregon has access to the insurance and care they deserve. And yet we've also seen the health of Oregonians worsen. Our foundation had to face the hard fact that we live in a country and a state where your life expectancy is predicted more by your zip code than your genetic code. For us, this has meant a recognition that health begins and is shaped most powerfully by underlying factors, which are often labeled the social determinants of health. And this is where we think, frankly, that we have the best chance to make lasting improvements in the health of every Oregonian. As the Institute of Medicine outlined in their 2012 report on primary care and public health, achieving health requires action in three principal domains. Number one, healthcare services for individuals. Number two, public health activities that target populations and address individual health behaviors like smoking, diabetes, alcoholism. But of course, number three is the social, economic, and environmental conditions that act as the primary determinants of individual and population health. So as you can see in this first chart, it is social determinants that are the primary driver of health. And yet, as the second chart shows, most health interventions that we invest in happen at the individual level. And indeed, we have a lot to show for our investments and our progress in healthcare services and in public health activities. But on a macro level, as the third chart shows, we are spending in the wrong places. Compared to our peer nations, who are often spending similar amounts to the United States in combined social and healthcare spending, we still have health outcomes that rank towards the bottom. This contradiction was outlined beautifully in Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor's book, The American Healthcare Paradox. But we don't just need to bend the cost curve, we need to bend the intervention curve. And there's plenty we can do to achieve this. And in fact, much of Oregon's transformation efforts are a recognition and response to this effort. But we know there's a role that community benefit spending plays in shifting this too. We've seen that investments in, whether at the neighborhood, city, county, county, or state level can impact communities' health in powerful ways. In our recent analysis of our own grant making in social determinants of health from 2005 through 2013, we saw that our investment resulted in 97 system changes that shifted, realigned, or dramatically altered the built environment, institutional practices, and public policies at all levels of government. Those 97 changes are available on our website in case you want to know all of them. But all of these changes got to the root causes of health, improving conditions that impact whole communities. And all of this investment could have been done with community benefit dollars, and indeed was supported by direct investment by Kaiser Permanente. Now, Oregon's hospitals are critical partners in the health of Oregonians. Beyond charity care and direct medical costs, their community benefit investments are doing great things outside the walls of hospitals. In 2015, as we saw in the most recent report from the health authority, they invested $67 million in direct community investment, from health fairs to free screenings. And when we look at the community health needs assessments of most of the hospitals in Oregon, they often cite investment in the social determinants to be a key strategy in their community health improvement plans. This connection between the CHNA and social determinants bears out nationally in a recent study done by the Milken Institute School of Public Health at George Washington. Yet, as their study and our own experience in Oregon shows, we lack a clear tie between the community health needs assessment and community benefit investments. Moreover, we don't have the current tracking system in place to say whether and how these community benefit investments improved the social determinants of health. Though we lack as much national direction from the IRS as we'd like, Northwest Health Foundation believes there's an opportunity to define social determinants in the context of community benefit and attract this spending at the state level. We can do all of this without doing away with the federal categories that hospitals already track under. Such an effort would give our state, our hospital partners, and our community members an important tool to better align these investments and to improve evaluation and impact on the health of Oregonians. This is a critical part to bending that intervention curve. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I was on that founding board as well. Your foundation, very proud of the work you've done. It's been very impressive. Are there any questions, Mr. Beast? Thank you very much. As we begin to amend that bill, I hope you might propose some amendments that might.
I think we're working on that right now.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenwood.
My last person, Keith Harrell.
Keith Harrell, please. Should we turn the lights on, or?
He has a PowerPoint.
We'll keep the lights off.
Chair, as you recall, that's how I first met you, was on that board.
Excuse me?
That's how I first met you many years ago, was on that board. Northwest Health Foundation.
Yeah, indeed.
That's how I knew you.
That's right. That's exactly right. We share that. It's fun.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the time to speak with you about community benefit. And what I'd like to do is cover what's been happening back in Washington, D.C. at a federal level around community benefit for hospitals. And that's where my small consulting firm is located. Just by way of background, I spent some time in public accounting, and in the late 80s developed really the first community benefit accounting methodology, and this was for the Catholic Health Association. So if you fast forward roughly 30 years to today, that work is now the foundation of IRS Form 990 Schedule H. So I've been sort of at the ground level of defining community benefit, figuring out which activities should be reported, and then understanding how best to put the numbers to each of these different activities.
I said to Mr. Hurl earlier in the day, Nobody should be willing to take credit for the 990 if anybody's ever tried to fill one out.
Yes. Credit and blame, I think, is the right set of terms. So what I'd like to do is first provide a brief overview of how we got to our current regulatory framework at a federal level. So until about 2006, hospitals were granted federal tax exemption based on two revenue rulings, one from 1956 and one from 1969. The 1956 revenue ruling spoke to providing charity care up to the financial ability of the hospital, and the one in 1969 is what we refer to as the community benefits standard. And that refers to hospitals having a community board, an open medical staff, and reinvesting any excess funds back into facilities, programs, medical education, research, those types of activities. So that's been the community benefit standard really all the way up until 2006-2007, when we had growing concerns about the accountability of our tax-exempt hospitals. Really, were they really earning the valuable exemption that they receive at a federal level? We did have, in the 80s and 90s, real growth of the for-profit hospital community, and that led some academics to do comparisons. Let's look at the for-profit hospitals side by side with the tax-exempt hospitals, and let's see what's really different about the two types of organizations. And they weren't finding as many differences as one might expect. Part of the problem was how those differences were actually being tallied up and measured. And that was one of the large reasons why the Catholic Health Association, back in the late 80s, decided to put some real effort into a better accounting framework for hospital community benefit. Those concerns kept going, and they prompted Senator Chuck Grassley to encourage the Internal Revenue Service to do a better job with the 990 generally, including looking at executive compensation disclosures, but then also more information about hospital community benefit. And that's when we ended up with Form Schedule H. And I worked directly with the IRS on the instructions to the form and was at the table again as this entire community benefit reporting framework was carefully scrubbed by the federal government before it was actually baked into the tax form. So in 2010, federal exemption standards changed again, and that was done through the Affordable Care Act. There's a section of the ACA devoted to hospital tax exemption standards, and that added in the community health needs assessment requirements, as well as some standards for financial assistance policies, billing and collections practices, things of that nature. We had to wait about 4 years to get from the law itself to the final regulations, which really explained how hospitals had to implement these new requirements. And so that's the rightmost box. We got the final regulations just over 2 years ago. I have an arrow going back to Schedule H because the federal government is using Schedule H as a way of checking compliance with those new 501R regulations. So just to summarize, the current federal exemption framework has these components: some revenue rulings, which are still in effect. They were not replaced by the Affordable Care Act. The ACA requirements add on top of those. Then we had Schedule H come into effect in 2008. One important thing here is that Schedule H and the 990, it's filed by organization. It's not filed by hospital facility. So some organizations, they're called EINs, employer identification numbers. The 990 may include five hospitals. There's one health system where it's 45 hospitals. It may include a hospital and a foundation. It really depends on what is wrapped into that reporting entity. So one reason to have maybe different reporting at a state level is the states can require facility-by-facility information, which really doesn't exist at a federal level. So 501R has the needs assessment requirement, policy requirements around charity care programs, and similar types of things. We do know that the IRS is actively reviewing compliance with 501R. The needs assessment is to be posted on websites, the financial assistance policy also on the website. And IRS examiners are actually checking every hospital's websites to download that information and see if it's aligned with the requirements. So in terms of community benefit reporting, if you pull a Schedule H, this is the bottom half of the very first page. And I still remember designing this back in 1989 using Lotus 1-2-3 on my computer. Well, what we have here are the rows or each of the categories of what the federal government considers to be community benefit. We have financial assistance, which is charity care, Medicaid shortfalls. Then we have the cost of other means-tested government programs. That does not include things like services through the VA program or Medicare. Those are not means-tested programs. So the intent here is to we're providing access to care for low-income individuals through Medicaid or our financial assistance policies. Then we have what's called community health improvement services. Those are the public health-oriented programs. You do see social determinants of health falling into that category. We have health professions education, and this is where our teaching hospitals are training interns and residents and nursing students and medical students and providing more clinicians across Oregon and the nation. Then we have subsidized health services, and these are clinical programs that hospitals provide even though they lose money. And the typical example of this is a mental health unit, where the community really needs the psych beds, but the hospital providing them loses money, but they keep doing that because the need is there, their needs assessment shows that the need is there. And this is one of the big differentiators between a nonprofit hospital, tax-exempt, and a for-profit. The researchers have really found that. Another, of course, is...
Excuse me a moment.
Yes.
Representative Malmstrom?
I'm kind of following this on the computer because it's hard to read up here.
Sure.
As far as on your community health improvement services and community benefit operations, can you give some more specific examples of that?
Sure. One is community health education. It's where staff at the hospital go out and explain to members of the community, maybe diabetic patients, here's how you can manage your health needs at home and avoid the need to come in for an emergency episode, for example. Another category would be healthcare support services, and these are ways to help lower-income patients get access to the hospital. And one thing that hospitals do is they help patients sign up for Medicaid eligibility and for the exchanges. And there's been some debate: do we count that as that effort as community benefit or not? The reason perhaps not to is it generates revenue for the hospital when you convert a patient from uninsured to Medicaid. But the reason to count it is you're also opening up access to care for that individual, and you're providing a service that would otherwise fall to government. That's one of the bases of tax exemption, that if the hospital does this work, you're relieving an expense of government. So those are examples of things that fall into that. Other key examples are the social determinants investments that were mentioned earlier. And these are all community-based outreach types of programs that hospitals increasingly are doing. And it's in response to they find a problem in their needs assessment. They then bake that issue into their implementation strategy, and then the spending shows up here on Schedule H. And this is all evolutionary. It all does tie together. Over time, we should expect more and more spending in that one row, the community health improvement row, as the strategic planning around community health needs unfolds.
Okay. Follow up? Yes. One of the things that I have kind of found frustrating is that there's lots of community education classes that different, hospitals and institutions offer, and some charge, some don't, some have sliding fee. It's kind of confusing, and I've helped people try to navigate through that. So is that going to get any simpler?
Not from the federal government. No, I don't perceive that.
I didn't know if they gave any assistance at all or...
No, what the Catholic Health Association, they have a group actually called the What Counts Task Force, and it's been up and running now for some time, providing guidance to hospitals as to what types of programs we should be counting in each of these buckets and which ones we shouldn't be. And as I'll explain in a second, the key test here is the program more about benefiting the community, or is it more about benefiting the hospital through some kind of marketing focus? And that's the key judgment. Is it more about benefiting the organization or about the community? And that's where some judgment comes into place, and this task force actually works collectively to try to come up with that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. When we talk about the 990H form and the community benefit, considering Oregon is looking at putting 5% of our healthcare revenue towards community benefit, on these social determinant programs, is there a requirement with the IRS for those to be done per location, meaning can somebody in the hospital, obviously the health, the physical procedure, if you're talking about that, but I'm talking about the educational programs, if they hand them a brochure that educates them about stopping smoking in the hospital setting as part of the routine, is that considered a community benefit, or do those have to be done physically in the community, or is there no location requirement?
There's no location requirement. It doesn't have to be out in the community outside the four walls of the hospital to count as a community benefit. But that's the clear direction of all this policy, to get out into the community and do this kind of work. And one category here is it's called contributions for community benefit. So the hospitals don't have to do this work themselves. They can support community-based organizations as they do this work. And I'm the board chair of a federally qualified health center, and we work with our local hospital system, and they support us financially. And so that's an example of supporting somebody else in the community who may be a little more closer to the ground and able to do this work.
You're generating some questions. How far are you on the presentation you want to make? We'll see how we can fit it in.
I can go for another 5 or 10 minutes just rapidly through, and then
okay,
more questions.
Okay, why don't you do that, and then we'll
sure,
have 5 or 10 minutes for questions. I think we need to be ready to move to the next topic by about 4.
Well, I had stopped at subsidized health services. Again, those are the clinical loss leaders that we still provide as hospitals because the community really needs those services. Research is another bucket, and this is not all the research done in the hospital. It's only the publicly funded or tax-exempt funded research, with the results being made publicly available and advancing knowledge for all of us. That's as opposed to clinical trials for Pfizer or one of the drug companies. And the last bucket is the cash and in-kind contributions. Just to get at the definition of community benefit, and it's important to understand this because this is the filter through which judgments were made on what we count and what we don't. There are 5 key criteria to count something as community benefit. The first is it needs to respond to a community health need. And then below that, we have it meeting certain objectives, one being improving access to health services. And you can read into that for those who experience barriers to getting access. So that's where the charity care comes in, the Medicaid services, that's where that becomes reportable, and also the subsidized health services. Then we have enhancing public health. And that's where the social determinants investments come in, community health improvement. Advancing generalizable knowledge, that's where the health professions education and research become reportable. And then here we have relief of government burden to improve health. And that gets back to the basis for exemption, that if the hospitals weren't doing this work, it would fall to government in some form or fashion to find a way to deliver care for Medicaid recipients and some of these public health programs. This is quoted straight out of the instructions to Schedule H in the 990, and it's also based largely on the Catholic Health Association's work. We have different ways of establishing need for these programs. One is through the needs assessment. Also, if we're working collaboratively with our health department or the school systems or even other hospitals on a community problem, that is defined almost per se as establishing need for the program. Things we don't count are programs that are primarily for marketing purposes and also programs that fail this overall test. Is it more about benefiting the organization or about benefiting the community? So is it about referrals? Is it about things that are required under licensure? If it's about those types of things, we don't count that as going beyond what's required to be a community benefit. Some other guidance that I often provide, and this is not in the instructions, but it's the first one here is called the prudent layperson test. I used to call this the Joe the Plumber test. If a community member knew all the facts about a specific program, would they say, oh, you're crazy to count this as community benefit, it's really marketing. It's generally not a good idea to report that as community benefit on your tax form. IRS examiners come into reviewing these forms as lay people, and so you really want that perspective to be there.
I think buying naming rights to a stadium wouldn't necessarily qualify.
That would not pass the laugh test. I mentioned this What Counts Task Force. But what happens is people, health systems, type in questions. Do you think I should count this or not count that? And sometimes it doesn't pass the laugh test because the task force actually laughs about it. It really doesn't quite get there. There are a number of accounting principles as well that govern the way you fill out these forms. I won't go into the accounting mechanics, but the basic point is we want the accounting to be as rigorous here in terms of community benefit as it is in other financial reports that we submit for reimbursement, like our Medicaid cost report or other types of things. So it's a serious effort to get the numbers right. And folks at the Catholic Health Association, myself, we've really worked hard to try to tighten this up so it's really as bulletproof as possible and we can do good benchmarking of one hospital up against another. In terms of issue areas, a number of issues have been discussed, debated, and resolved over the years in terms of what we report and what we don't. One is bad debt expense. Do we count that as community benefit? The answer is absolutely not. One of the IRS staff actually said bad debt is toxic to community benefit. It's the idea of trying to collect a patient bill for, you know, 3 or 4 months and then being unsuccessful and then counting that expense as community benefit. That's not opening up access to care. It really doesn't satisfy the definition. Medicare is not reported at a federal level, and I helped CHA and the IRS decide this. We don't count Medicare because it's really not a differentiator between the taxable, the for-profit hospitals, and the tax-exempt hospitals. We also, though, can count Medicare programmatically as community benefit. You have that subsidized health services bucket. So if we have a heavy Medicare program that loses money, and it is needed by the community, there is a way to count it programmatically. So it's not correct to say we don't count any Medicare as community benefit. We only do it programmatically, and that's the way it's done on the 990. Other issues, there's a category called community building, which historically the Catholics have always included that as community benefit. The IRS did not. But what the IRS has said is if you've got a program like maybe an investment in a neighborhood park, that could be viewed as community building, but if you have good evidence that you're actually improving health, you can count that in the community health improvement bucket. So there's been a way to move some dollars from community building to community benefit if the evidence is there that, in fact, you've got a program that's improving community health. Other types of issues, restrictions on contributions made. The IRS requires a hospital to place a restriction on the contribution they make so that the recipient only can use it for a community benefit as defined by the IRS. An example is my clinic. If I get dollars from the local health system, that health system has to say to me, you must use it for charity care, you must use it for Medicaid, before the hospital can count it as community benefit. And the IRS did that because they want to be sure that every dollar on that table, in fact, is providing community benefit. If you give an unrestricted contribution, the funds could be used for a billboard or could be used for by the recipient. So it's been very carefully constructed that way. Another thing that has been debated back in Washington is whether or not we do need a bright line test, like a certain percentage of expense being devoted to community benefit or some kind of excise tax being kicked in. The debate so far has led to no bright line test, and it's because it's recognized that communities vary so much across the United States that establishing any kind of bright line test might have some unintended consequences. Plus, there are certain types of hospitals that would have trouble hitting certain bright line tests, like a children's hospital, for example, which really has very little charity care because almost all the kids are covered through Medicaid or have some kind of coverage, different from an adult facility. So when you look at different hospital types, you end up with some different issues around establishing a bright line test.
Can I ask you to wrap up so we can get to a couple
sure,
of questions?
Sure, that's fine. Just also in the other areas at a federal level, there have been some issues that came up around the needs assessment work and the charity care policy work, just highlighting a couple of those. How do we make sure that hospitals get a lot of input from their local public health departments when the assessments are pulled together? So that's required as these assessments get done. And then there are questions also, how do hospitals decide that these are the top needs in my community and then decide, well, these are the ones we're actually going to do, we're going to do something about? The IRS requires a lot of transparency around how those decisions were made. They're not mandating any particular number of needs be met or any particular strategies be put into place. In terms of the financial assistance side of things, the charity care side, a lot of effort was put into these regulations around widely publicizing the financial assistance policy. That means everybody in the community finding out, we've got a charity care policy here, here's how to find the application, here's a summary of it, here's the assistance you can get in filling it out. There are rules around how much time people have to apply for their charity care programs, and lots of rules around what hospitals have to do prior to what's called an extraordinary collections action, which is like adverse credit reporting or some kind of legal judgment. They have to do a lot of work to make sure that the patient is not eligible for their financial assistance policy before that can be done.
Mr. Early, I'm going to answer up for a couple of questions now, if I may.
Please.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to make two comments about the last two slides that you just showed in combination with when you came to my office. I really appreciate the clarity around that because I myself was not so aware of the requirement, actually, that the community needs assessment that has to be done every 3 years needs to be connected to the expenditures of the community benefits. And I just want to put on the record again, I know that the housing crisis came up as one of the main things in the community needs assessments by hospitals and CCOs around the state. And so I'm interested to see how much of their community benefits is going toward affordable housing. And so thank you for bringing that to light. And then on the second one that you just had, I also was not so aware of that. So I really want to thank you for the decades of work that you've put into this and shining a transparency light on this and helping us understand what the requirements are to maintain nonprofit status. The question I have for you is there a floor on the expenditure amount, what percentage you have to spend on community benefits in order to retain nonprofit status?
Not today. There is no such floor. It's gotten debated quite a lot. I will tell you, I explained to Senate Finance Committee staff on the charity care number, for example, I said to the former, one of the staffers to Senator Grassley, to me, it's most important of what the actual policy is, the financial assistance policy, and whether or not it's widely publicized. That, to me, is the patient experience is more important than the number that comes out on the tax form. So, and what the eligibility levels are, for example, those are the key criteria for figuring out if you've got a generous and well-administered charity care program. At the other end of it, you get a certain number, like that 1.5% number that was cited earlier. But the patient experience, to me, is what really matters. And I guess that had some impact because the next thing we knew, we had some very detailed regs now around the financial assistance policy requirements.
Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to briefly kind of try to make a connection between the high deductibles and the debt carried by some folks that was brought up earlier that is very concerning. Is this the charity care can be used for that? Is it when that doesn't happen, is it the lack of communication between the hospital and the patients? Is it a lack of being able to qualify? Who determines who qualifies? How is that? What happens? And if we are missing that, how, Where's the disconnect there, or do you know?
Well, at a federal level, the IRS did not specify eligibility requirements. They certainly did say that you can grant charity care to uninsured individuals, and you can grant charity care to underinsured individuals, those with those high deductible plans left with a big out-of-pocket responsibility. And they went into details as to how you calculate the discounts made available to both categories of patients. But they didn't go as far as saying, for example, everybody up to 200% of poverty gets free care up to 400%. They did not go that far.
You have an affirmative charity care program. It's not that when somebody comes in and you find out they need help, you organize that help on an advanced basis rather than
waiting to send
it off to become a bad debt. Thank you very much for coming. This has been very interesting. This is an issue we're going to be grappling with over the next month or so, and I think you've helped shed some light on a very complex issue.
Thank you.
More complex than the Form 990. I'm going to close the informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2679. And ask Representative Noes and Senator Beyer to join us to introduce the topic. So we have lights back on. Good, thank you. Aren't you happy we took you away from having to listen to all that testimony, Senator Beyer?
Welcome to AT&T's teleconference service. Enter your access code.
Right, I'm going to go let you kick off.
Okay.
Be nice.
You be nice?
Sure.
Open, you ready to go?
Go for it.
Go for it.
Enjoy the conference as the host. Press star. Otherwise, press pound. Please enter your host password followed by the pound sign. There are 1 participants on the call, including you, who are joining your conference as the host. For a menu of available commands,
go for it.
You ready? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm a state senator from Senate District 6, which is Central Lane and Linn Counties. And I'm here today just to speak in support of House Bill 2679, which actually is a mirror of Senate Bill 419 and kind of a follow-up of a similar bill in 2015 that the Representative Noes and I both sponsored at that time. What it is about, it's a healthcare cost containment concept that proposes a hospital rate setting process that's based on a Maryland model. That model has been in place since 1971. And I guess the question would be, why consider this? And the real reason is that, as you well know, I've been working on this a lot longer than I have, hospital costs are one of the things that are pushing general healthcare costs up the fastest. The experience in Maryland, as we look at that, is that they have held hospital costs down significantly more than the other 49 states together. The system is viewed by all the participants in Maryland, hospitals, medical professionals, insurance companies, and regulators, very favorably. In fact, I would note that where the idea came from in Maryland in 1971 was actually from the Hospital Association, who came forward and proposed the state get into the business of regulation as a way to hold down costs and actually share some of those costs statewide. But it's worked there. As I look at the hospital cost structure, I see it as being an awful lot like the hotel industry, if you can think about that. In that industry, there's a standard rate, but only the people who walk through the front door without prior contact actually pay that rate. Everybody else negotiates a different rate and usually a much lower rate than that. And that's true in the hospital industry, too. If you're the single payer that doesn't have insurance or doesn't have somebody else negotiating on your behalf, you get the full bill, while everybody else is paying anywhere from half of that cost to something else. I note that one of the things I noticed, I spent about 10 years on the board of directors of a community hospital in Springfield. And from that experience, I became convinced that the process of negotiating prices actually drives up costs in some ways. And I guess the other piece that I came to believe is that when you were looking at it all and talking with our CFO and others at that time, nobody really knew what the true cost was of providing the service because they're negotiating across the board. And there was a lot of cost shifting. One of the questions or one of the criticisms that we heard in 2015 was that this is a much too complicated subject matter for a regulatory agency to deal with. And actually, I think hospitals are an awful lot like the utility industry or some of the insurance industry, which are both very highly regulated industries. As my almost decade as the chief utility regulator for the state of Oregon, I am very familiar with that model, and I think it's very transferable to hospitals. I don't think that's a problem at all. You would have to have some different personnel involved, and it would take a while to develop that, but you can do it. And the real proof in the pudding of that is Maryland has done it successfully, and as I started out saying, they have kept costs down more than any other state has. I will acknowledge that they do have a Medicare waiver, the only one, although in numbers that I've seen, their rates when compared to other states on Medicare are actually less than the national average for that. So I don't know how exactly it compares to Oregon. I haven't seen that.
It might be what they had to do to get the
waiver. You know, it's in the current environment, it's quite possible that we might be able to talk about that next year. So I think that's really what I want to say is that the bill as it is in front of you, I think probably is not directly implementable. But where I would like to actually suggest to you is that when we view it, that we take a look at it in the interim, that we actually create a study group or task force, whatever the formal thing is, and take a serious look at that and see how it matches with our other cost containment methods in the state. We know from our experience that our CCOs are making some positive direction at holding costs down, but at the same time, those who are paying private insurance are not. They're not getting the benefit of that. And the model that we've seen, as I said, in Maryland, is working very well in that state. And I think there's something to be learned there. At least there's something to look at as a way to continue our efforts to hold costs down in Oregon. So, Mr. Chair, that's essentially what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
And
I hope you'll consider it. Let's see if anybody has any questions on you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller had a question, and maybe somebody else says, let's let him ask the question, and then, because I'm here all the time.
I chair the meeting, and you be a witness.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't understand, I did nothing for you, Representative Bueller.
I'm just going to be a committee member.
Yeah, I saw what you did. Representative Nose, would you please present questions for the two of you?
So for the record, my name is Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which consists of inner southeast Portland and a little sliver of northeast Portland. I don't like to be forgotten. And Mr. Chair, before I start, I'm curious if there are any drug manufacturer lobbyists behind me, because they've accused me of only focusing on one aspect of the problem of healthcare costs.
They're trailing you everywhere you go.
And
so
I
sure
I would like them to witness me getting up here before you to talk about another part of the healthcare economy and what we might do to make its cost structure more rational and maybe less expensive. I don't know if the sergeant at arms can bar the door and ask them to get down here, but so I think we've all heard stories about hospital charges and a list price that no one pays. So in preparation for this hearing, I went onto the internet and attempted to find something to help me estimate the cost of a procedure at a hospital. I picked having a baby, a normal vaginal delivery, and a cesarean C-section. I spent 5 minutes trying to find a price, and I gave up. First, you can't find anything easily on the web for the cost of these procedures in hospitals in Oregon. The estimates I could find come from national websites. They're outdated, and they show a range of price as opposed to an actual price. So in 2014, for a vaginal delivery in Oregon, one site estimated the cost between $7,600 and $9,700 for a two-day stay in the hospital. Now, that's a $2,000 difference, but at least it was an estimate. For cesarean with a three-day hospital stay, it was $14,000 to $17,700. Another website, also not super specific, estimated a normal vaginal delivery at $7,848, but they only had data for 2010, and for cesarean, they estimated it was $20,288, also for 2010. Finally, I Googled what it costs at a few large hospitals in the Portland metro area. I used several different hospitals specifically named, and I had no luck that way either. It was easier to figure out what tuition is at OHSU for a med student than it was to figure out what I would pay to have a baby at a hospital. Now, we all know, and as the senator pointed out, most nobody pays the list price. If you have insurance, you pay a copay or a percentage, or the cost of your insurance pays the rest. And with your current plan designs and HSAs, maybe knowing what is charged and what your exposure might be useful. At the same time, we know that different health insurance plans have worked out different rates with different hospitals. If your plan has worked out a good deal and has a network of preferred hospitals, you might pay one thing. And if you go to that hospital, if your plan does not have a network or you have an emergency delivery and you have to be seen out of network, you'll pay something else. And of course, we know that Oregon Health Plan patients don't pay anything. We also know that while a hospital might have a good deal on vaginal deliveries and a reasonable price, they either have to accept or charge more for a triple bypass in order to make up for the loss they're taking on vaginal deliveries. Or maybe on triple bypasses, they charge that price because that's what it costs, and their hospital does not do a lot of triple bypass surgeries. I think you get my point. This is hardly a market. Lack of competition, particularly in communities with only one hospital, insurance plans and the various rates and deals they have worked out, and the need for networks have really made this system irrational. It's not a true market, kind of like the drug market. We also know that many hospitals have recovered from the Great Recession, and since the full implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act, they're doing well financially. This state tracks for us. OHA puts together an awesome spreadsheet that I submitted for the record and should be on OLIS and shows the profit and loss and charity care trends for all the hospitals in the state of Oregon. Some hospitals are clearly struggling, like Coquille Hospital in Coquille, Oregon. They had a 17.4% loss. And that's pretty devastating, in my opinion. At the same time, our state's two only for-profit hospitals, McKenzie Willamette in Springfield and Willamette Valley, it's now not a community hospital anymore, each had a 33% margin on profit, and that's after their charity care expenses. While a loss of 18% is not a good thing for a rural hospital and should have us very concerned, I think a hospital that makes a 33% profit on healthcare should also have us equally concerned. Now, House Bill 2679 is a simple bill that, if implemented, would usher in big changes to the way we deal with hospital finance in this state. It creates a seven-person commission, the Hospital Rate Commission, appointed by the governor with the Oregon Health Authority for the purpose, you know, blah, blah, blah. The language is pretty straightforward and standard for a government board or commission. But I suspect that if we go down this road, we're going to need to amend the bill. The simplest explanation is that House Bill 2679 sets up a commission that establishes what hospitals could charge. If you have one price for a normal vaginal delivery in Portland and another in Bend, perhaps it would take into account the need to have basic infrastructure like a hospital in an area where the patient volume is not as high, and thus allow a higher charge for that vaginal delivery. But ideally, it would help set a charge for a procedure that would make sense and allow for understanding by patients and consumers about what things cost and why. I believe, though, I'm not certain that this is kind of what the Public Utility Commission does for investor-owned utilities. It sounds like you feel that way. You know, for these utilities to operate, they need to be an exclusive provider and have a monopoly. And since it's not a true market, that's why we regulate them. That's why we do rate review. And as near as I can tell, PGE, Northwest Natural, Pacific Power, and I think there's one other, and I can never remember which one it is, they're all doing fine under that system. I am very intrigued by this approach and what it could do for a very important industry and sector of our economy, but it would need a lot more work if we're going to adapt this approach to our state. You thought tasking me with the topic of high-cost drugs was hard, Representative Greenleg. We're hoping, I think someone from
Maryland. You're all set to take on another topic.
I know, I sure am, what the heck. I think someone from Maryland is here. We were hoping we were going to get someone from Maryland on the phone to be able to, but they're not able to do it. But I believe someone from Maryland might be here in the audience who has some experience with this, you know, that can explain it. Some states tried this in various variations in the 70s and 80s, but as Senator Beyer pointed out, Maryland's the only one that stuck with it. This thing would probably have a big fiscal. It would need a lot of staff to help this commission examine what should be charged instead of rates. I think the PUC board, they were full-time, right? That was your job. We might need to have a board, something like that, to be able to have somebody available to do this, to hear what these rates ought to be for the various hospitals in our state. We probably also need to have some ability to get control of Medicare and Medicaid money so that all the payers, including commercial insurance, the state and feds, are all charged and pay the same thing, so that one sector of patients is not deeply discounted and another's price overly inflated to cover that cost. I'm not sure how to do that. I suspect we'd have to get a waiver from the feds to implement our Medicaid and Medicare program in that manner, which probably means making this bill a little tough to do right now. I put on OLIS a pretty comprehensive report on this topic to the credit of the Hospital Association. They provided that to me. It's entitled Hospital Rate Setting, Revisiting. Very intriguing, you know, title for a report. Put out by the Urban Institute. It's 120 pages long, but the 20-page summary does a pretty good job, I think, of outlining the pros and cons and challenges that this approach would bring. So I'd suggest we look at it if we're serious about this. And I just can't help but add, you know, there's another way we could get at this. We could just do a single-payer system where the state negotiates the rates and what it would pay all the different hospitals. But I don't think that's the approach we're up to hearing today.
Representative Ewing, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. This topic, as you can imagine, brings up a lot of issues. As someone who spent a fair amount of time working in Maryland hospitals, I was able to watch some of this firsthand. So my experience when you price fix is many times you also cost shift, or you try to generate revenue from other sources. So do you have any idea what the number of admissions has done in Maryland hospitals when they institute this kind of scheme?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question.
Do you know how this affected the number of admissions? So if you price fix, usually some very creative entities try to gain revenue from other places. And I'd be concerned that admissions would go up if you fixed the price of hospitals.
My understanding...
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, my understanding is that there was some of that. They had some of that experience in the 70s, and it sounds like you had some personal experience there. And they instituted some other policies to protect that. But they also had a... And I'm not going to be able to describe it, but a sharing mechanism to cover charity costs and that sort of thing, too. So they socialized that over the system. But I have a...
So you don't know what admissions
a shorter say. Report than yours that I'm going to hand leave with you that I think has a pretty good description of it.
And just a follow-up. And from my experience, Maryland's hospital system is very unique because it's dominated by very large academic centers that control the market. It's not like Oregon where you have multiple other hospitals. So their ability to cost shift into other sources of revenue, such as research, especially the Hopkins system and medical education, that I think we need to be careful of drawing comparisons to a very unique healthcare system in one state. So that's just a comment, because another ability to cost shift is to bring those other sources of revenue. And then, do you know why this failed in New Jersey? My understanding, they had a very similar scheme there, and it failed. No.
Do not.
And then one final question, sir.
All right.
Would this commission also be able to fix the price of labor costs, such as nurses and SEIU employees? So the cost of the production of these services wouldn't go up more than what the commission fixed the price?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. Those are the kinds of things from my experience with regulating four different kinds of utilities, we were able to address that in a holistic way and hold the cost down.
I have a question I've asked the representative's question. It was highlighted by what he just said a few minutes ago. I'd like your comment on what a price is in the hospital. And when Representative Nose was talking about the price of a cesarean stay, that's one way to look at it. Another way would be sort of a price per day plus prices for ancillary services. How do you see what a price actually is compared to a certain amount of cents per kilowatt hour or something, which is pretty clear?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure you can make that comparison exactly. The Maryland model, as I understand it, and let me be real clear, I'm not an expert on it. I just think it's worth looking at. They developed their own units of service, days in hospitals, different costs per procedures that they came up with, and that were then comparable across the full range, all of the hospitals in the state of Maryland. And I thought they had more than what you're talking about. I thought they had something like 90 hospitals in the state, but I may be wrong about that.
They're controlled by one system, though.
One system?
Or two systems that are academic.
What attracted me to it, quite frankly, two things attracted me to the approach. One was the fact that it was established, or at least brought to the legislature in Maryland, by the Hospital Association. That was one. Second one was that their cost...
That was 40 years ago.
Huh?
40 years ago.
40 years ago. But that's true. But when they were around in 2015, the same people were saying, we like it a lot. And we heard in committee from both the hospital, representatives of the Hospital Association, the insurance companies, and the regulators, that they still felt very strongly that their system was working very well. The other one is numerically, their rates, as I said at the start, have been consistently, the most recent data I had, which is a couple of years old, was their rates were lower than everybody else, which I think is a fairly strong argument for looking at it.
We've got seven witnesses to talk about it, so thank you very much.
All right. I was just saying, to the committee, some of the questions that Representative Bueller asked are addressed in that 120-page report.
I'm serious. I have a shorter version, Mr. Chair, that I'm going to leave with you.
Would you call the... We have, what, four people in favor?
Yeah, we have Felicia Hagans, Paul McKenna, Kelly Coughlin.
And why don't we call all four? We can figure out a way to move the chairs.
Okay, and then Jared Mason Gear. But I don't see anybody that I called coming up.
All right, then we won't need four chairs.
Exactly.
All right, here we go. Go for it.
Chair Greenleg, for the record, committee members, my name is Felisa Hagans. I'm the political director of SEIU Local 49. You have my testimony in front of you on OLIS. I'd like to walk through that as quickly as I can, but also address some of the issues that were raised in some of the questions earlier, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think we're okay. Just try and hold, be parsimonious.
Great. We've already talked about the cost of healthcare in earlier presentations today. I think that there's no argument that healthcare is an expensive part of everyday Oregonians' lives. We all know that the hospitals are the largest recipient of the expenditures of healthcare. We believe strongly that the Maryland model can be effective and should be used in Oregon to hold down the overall cost of healthcare, and a rate system, review system that we have across other industries is effective, as Senator Beyer pointed out. You have the bill in front of you. I'd like to take into account some of the questions. So Representative Bueller, Chair Greenleg, asked the question about labor costs. So in the Maryland model, actually all hospital costs are taken into account. So depending on the facility, each of the various facilities get a different rate. There'll be another, I hope, well, it was stated that there might be someone from Maryland here to talk about that. So, but labor costs are included in that rate setting process when they go through each of the hospital rates. So it doesn't set the rate for employee costs, but the employee costs are included in the rate that the hospitals get. The other outline was the Maryland system and what the healthcare system looks like in Maryland that Representative Bueller raised. Maryland actually has a similar market when you look at the number of health systems that Oregon has, given the consolidation that Oregon has over the last few years, as well as a lot of small and rural independent hospitals. Senator Beyer alluded to the charity care and community benefit cost, which is a pooled model across all of the systems. So all of the systems contribute an amount of money to cover their charity care and community benefit costs based on their area, and then that money is redistributed back to the hospitals. Again, not my written testimony, but I thought I would run through those quickly, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Paul McKenna. I'm research director of SEIU Local 503, which represents about 25,000 state agency and public university employees who are members of Public Employee Benefits Board. Until recently, I was a board member for PEB, and from July 2014 to June 2016, I served as chair of the PEB board. I'm here today speaking on behalf of SEIU Local 503 to express support for HB 2679 from the perspective of a longtime PEB board member. According to a recent study, Oregon's rates for inpatient hospitalization are 27% above the average for other states. The study, which was conducted by the Network for Regional Healthcare Improvement, compared Oregon's provider rates, utilization, and overall costs with four other states, including Maryland, by the way. Oregon's overall unit costs, which includes hospital rates, physician rates, and pharmaceutical prices, were found by this study to be 17% above the average. The study also found that utilization in Oregon was 7% below the average, with inpatient utilization 15% below average. Overall costs, combining unit costs and utilization, were found to be 9% above average, with inpatient costs 8% above average. So just recapping, this study was saying that the hospital rates in Oregon are 27% above the average for other states, which is pretty striking. And this study is, by the way, is a new thing in terms of being able to compare data across states and make these type of comparisons. So it's potentially very powerful in terms of a tool for addressing this issue. From the perspective of PEB, unit costs are the largest cost driver for PEB's overall 2018 cost trend. According to Mercer, PEB's actuarial consultant, 7% of PEB's projected increase in costs for 2018 is attributable to unit costs. PEB's other primary cost drivers are utilization and member risk, the latter, which refers to the age and overall health characteristics of the PEB population. Utilization and member risks, unfortunately, are very difficult for PEB to control, certainly in the short run. So the controlling the unit costs becomes central. And it would be easy to limit PEB's projected cost increases by simply shifting costs to PEB members, by increasing member out-of-pocket costs. However, unlike hospital rates, compensation for state employees is not 27% above average. On this point, a study conducted by the Department of Administrative Services in 2016 found that total compensation for state workers, including salaries and benefits combined, is already slightly below the total compensation for comparable employees in the Northwest private sector. Salaries alone for state of Oregon employees are 12% behind the private sector. So cutting employee health benefits, shifting costs as a strategy to meet PEB's cost targets would put compensation for state of Oregon employees even further behind the private sector, making it even more difficult for state agencies to recruit and retain the qualified employees that state agencies need and rely on to accomplish their missions. So this highlights the importance of limiting the increase in PEB's unit costs, especially provider rates, as a critical mechanism for helping PEB limit cost increases, not to mention the cost increases in other publicly funded healthcare programs, including OEB, for example. Limiting these cost increases, in turn, will allow the state to invest in critical public services that might be on the chopping block. In addressing provider rates and working to bring them under control, PEP can certainly direct its insurance carriers to take a harder line with providers in negotiating rates. However, PEP could definitely use the legislature's assistance in achieving this goal. Setting up a process for hospital rate review, as proposed in HB 2679, would be an important component of an overall strategy to limit or reduce hospital rates, which is clearly needed in order to limit the overall increase in PEP's costs and in health care costs for Oregonians in general. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a comment. You talk about hospital costs, but we're actually talking about hospital prices, not hospital costs.
Well, I was referring, that's when I say provider point. Rates, when I was talking about 27%, that's hospital rates. This study breaks it into three components. Rates, which they call unit costs, utilization, and then cost overall, which combines rates and utilization. So on the unit cost or the inpatient unit cost factors where they're 27% above average.
Not unit costs, or they're unit prices.
Well, okay, yeah. The study used the word cost, but really, I think you're right. It's more accurate to say prices. I was using the word rates.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Jared Mason here, representing the Oregon Education Association, 44,000 educators around the state serving approximately 600,000 K-12 students and 70,000 community college students. I spend most of my time in healthcare committees here today because our members are increasingly seeing, both experiencing themselves, the impacts of rising healthcare costs on their families, on the school districts that they serve, and on the students and families that they serve. You have written testimony from me. You have received and will be receiving written testimony from some of our members detailing the firsthand experience they have with the results of rising health care costs. So I will not go through all of that, but wanted to, express one bit of departure from the champions of the legislation, which is we believe that there's a real urgency in addressing what is, you know, known to be, I think, you know, you've had many conversations already about the role that hospital costs play in driving out of control healthcare costs and healthcare spending for the average families and for state and local governments and school districts. And we'll just look forward to continuing to have conversations with you to move this legislation forward because we do think that there's a great deal of urgency. Thank you.
Got two people, Kenny Geyer and Bueller.
I'm Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Nose, for bringing this yet another cost-cutting idea to the table. In the Urban Institute report, it also talks about the West Virginia model, which sets floor and ceiling and the ability for commercial payers to find something in between. I thought that was interesting. I'd love your input on that. And the other way to get at it would be something more like our health insurance rates and our utility rates, where the hospital would have to say, this is our cost, and it would have to be approved. So those are three ideas.
This is our price.
Sorry? Did I say the wrong word? Price?
Well, price. There's an important difference between price and cost.
I'm sorry, I meant price. I know, I get the difference, and
we could control cost. That would be a really good thing.
So,
when price is a different issue.
Exactly. So, thank you for that clarification. Price. Negotiating on price and having to prove that the price is related to the cost. So I'm just curious, because those are three different ideas. Your bill deals with the price fixing, and there's two other ideas that could get at this. I'm just curious about your response.
Representative Greenlick, Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. I think that there are multiple ways to go at this issue. I think that the West Virginia model of the floor and the ceiling, I think, is a little restrictive, and that range could be either wildly large or too restrictive and not allow flexibility. I think the Maryland model and the rate approval model is a more flexible model, especially when you have hospitals that operate wildly differently and in wildly different areas of the state, which provide for different sort of set costs. For example, if you're trying to recruit and retain rural doctors in Harney County, you may have to pay them more or reimburse medical education more or do other things to get them to stay there, especially when it comes to specialists. So they need flexibility, and that flexibility should be included in the rates that they're charging. I'm sorry, that's the opinion of SEIU, just to be clear.
Yeah, I appreciate your efforts to try to contain labor costs within our schools and hospital stuff. What are the primary drivers of labor costs in our schools right now? Is it health care, or is it other post-employment benefits like PERS? And would you be willing to accept cost controls in that area also?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Bueller. So the question is, would we accept cost controls in other areas?
Yeah, you expressed a lot of concern about the increasing cost to your members and to school districts from such things as health care. Would you be willing to accept cost controls and other post-employment benefits like PERS?
I appreciate the question. So, as you're probably aware, we're engaged in extensive conversations around PERS. We are, I think there's a handful of differences in those conversations. I mean, one, I think, is when you look at executive compensation, cash reserves, profits in the sphere of hospitals is a pretty dramatic difference than the salary of a teacher or a school custodian or cafeteria worker. I also think there's a great deal of difference in the legalities, kind of the legal framework that we're working in the two different conversations. I think that there's a great deal of space where we can be working to control costs in the sphere of hospitals and pharmaceuticals and so forth. I think that we have a pretty limited framework to work within in some of these other spheres. So certainly we're looking at ways that costs can be saved across the board. And we believe that this is an important aspect of that to address some of the root causes of increasing health care costs.
I'm going to interrupt. I'd like to make sure we hear from some opponents on this as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can you call the next panel?
We have Joyce Neumeyer and James Parr and Robert Murray. Are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Why don't you start, Mr. Murray?
Mr. Murray, you can start.
Okay. Is it okay for me to start? I'm sorry.
Yes. Please just introduce yourself as you begin.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, my name is Robert Murray. I'm currently a management consultant in the healthcare industry, specializing in payment methods and design of payment systems for hospitals and physicians. My professional experience, I was the deputy director and the executive director of the Maryland Hospital Rate Setting System for 18 years, from 1993 to 2011. I've done a little bit of writing and research. I published a number of articles when I was at the commission in Maryland and since. In fact, I think I authored the two papers that are before you, the one, a large 120-page report on rate setting, the history of rate setting. And then I think a smaller report on the Maryland system. I generally am an advocate of this type of approach, but I also am acutely aware of how challenging it can be and complicated it can be. So I'd like to make a few general comments and then maybe refer to some of the questions that have been discussed a little bit earlier and provide some of my thoughts on these questions, and then generally open it up for questions to members of the committee. The general points I would like to make is that rate setting is really not for the faint of heart. The health secretary in Maryland used to like to refer to the rate setting system there the way Homer Simpson characterized alcohol, which is that the Maryland rate setting system was both the cause of and the solution to all life's problems. And I think there's some truth to that. So one just needs to kind of understand what you may be in for. The report that was distributed, 120-page report, it's 120 pages for a reason. Rate setting, it can be extraordinarily complicated. And, in fact, that is what I would argue why a lot of the states dropped rate setting, is because it became too complex and less effective over time. The point I would make about Maryland is, yes, I think Maryland did it very well, reasonably well. It all stems from the statute, the original Maryland statute. I would note that the bill that's before you today does not provide an outline for a Maryland type of model. It differs very, very much from the original Maryland statute. But having a good statute is not enough. Washington State, back in the 1980s, basically adopted Maryland's statute word for word, and their rate-setting system failed in implementation. A couple of quick points about the requirements of an effective rate-setting system. First, it's very important, and Maryland realized this right off the bat, that the rate-setting system be all-payer, that it apply to both commercial patients as well as Medicare and Medicaid. And as was mentioned earlier, that would require that the state negotiate a Medicare waiver. That would mean that the Medicare agency, would pay the rates that your rate-setting commission sets in lieu of the rates that they set for hospitals nationally. That is not beyond the realm of possibility. The feds would require savings over time to negotiate such a waiver, and it could be significant savings that would be required. The other thing to think about, at least now, is that the landscape at the federal level is very uncertain. Unfortunately, you'd probably have to wait for a tweet from the president to find out whether... And then you might be in a position of getting a tweet from the president several months or years later saying the waiver had been terminated. The point being that the waivers at the federal level are at the discretion of federal government as to whether they continue or not. Just a couple of points about the research resource requirements of rate setting. As I said, it's not for the faint of heart. It really does require significant resources. The current Maryland Commission budget, I think, is a little over $13 million per year for the operation of the commission. That includes primarily salaries, but also consulting support. But it requires pretty technical resource skills of professional staff in setting up data systems, reporting systems, other administrative challenges, the ability to handle hearings and appeals, so you need a legal staff, a pretty robust research and methodology department, generally hiring people with reimbursement expertise and also PhD health economists and other folks with policy experience. We also were challenged in Maryland in court a number of times. We were challenged once when I was executive director, and five or six times at the outset of rate setting, challenged largely by hospitals, but also by members in the payer community. Fortunately, we won most of those legal challenges, but other systems like New Jersey, in part, were taken out because of a legal challenge. That there was an argument that rate setting in New Jersey was violative of the ERISA statute nationally. It turned out that ruling was overturned by the Supreme Court years later, but too late for the rate setting system in New Jersey. It was abandoned earlier on. So again, the points are that rate setting has some merit, but it is a very challenging undertaking. And also, one of the first things to think about is to get your statute structured and aligned so that it can give some degree of flexibility to the rate-setting agency, basically do what Maryland statute did, which is outline the objectives and the goals and the principles and priorities. It's something that could be particularly very uncertain at this point, given the circumstances at the federal level. The last things that I would want to mention is, again, just emphasize that the current bill is not a Maryland model. It departs very significantly from our statute and does not outline a Maryland type of rate-setting system. I just wanted to mention also part of the reason why Maryland, the constituents and the stakeholders view Maryland, particularly the hospitals, view it very favorably, is because Maryland actually receives about $2 billion extra a year in payments from Medicare. This is a function of when the waiver was originally negotiated back in 1977. Our Medicare payments were more than 30% above the U.S. average. Now, we've whittled that down a bit over time, but the waiver, the existence of the waiver brings in $2 billion additional Medicare reimbursement and higher Medicaid reimbursement than would be the case if the waiver didn't exist. So that extra payment is something that has galvanized support for the system. And it makes it very difficult for other states to get in and get that same type of deal. That would be virtually impossible to get a similar arrangement. A couple of other just quick points. The cost-shifting point that was raised earlier, you always have to think about unintended consequences. Our original system was fixing payment per case, so we had a per-case control system. And we did a good job of controlling the rate of growth of per-case payments or prices, but the unintended or consequence of that is that hospitals did more cases. They did more volume. And we got into a really big difficulty with regard to excess procedures and admissions in the state. Now, that was part of the main reason why we then moved in 2011 towards more of a fixed budget system, which is the current model, setting global budgets for Maryland hospitals. That is a more effective cost control mechanism for controlling total costs, the per capita costs, but it also has its challenges as well. And the Maryland system, although it's done reasonably well, is facing certainly some challenges moving forward, particularly at whether their waiver will be continued.
Mr. Marine, this is wonderful, I have to say. I'm going to ask you to finish. Can you hold on while we hear a couple more witnesses? I'd really appreciate
that. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Please go for it.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead. I'm going to wait.
Okay. My name is Joyce Neumeyer, and I am the CEO of the Pacific Northwest region of Adventist Health. My region includes two hospitals in Oregon, one in Tillamook and one in Portland.
Can you move that mic over a little?
Just a little closer.
Sure. I was trying to be sure I didn't get feedback for you.
You're okay.
Prior to that, I was 5 years in the state of Maryland as a hospital CEO for Washington Adventist Hospital. So I suspect I'm one of the people who has been referred to several times this afternoon is one, those with Maryland experience. Let me also say that I was very pleased when I first came to the state of Oregon to work and live, and it's a privilege to do so, in 2014, when in 2015 Senate Bill 900 was passed that had hospitals listing prices and rates, I would say what is expected to be collected, to be clear, under the OregonHospitalGuide.com. It's not an exhaustive list. I will say it's more progressive than any other state that I've worked in. So I haven't looked up whether a normal vaginal delivery is there, but you can bet I will after I go home. So I'm pleased that that is available here in Oregon. I worked under the old waiver. When I say the old waiver, this waiver, it, as was noted, came into effect in the 1970s. And what's interesting is that it, while it was successful for several years, it ultimately was failed. About 2012, 2013, the conversations heated up about how close we were of breaching the waiver cushion. What that basically means is we were getting too close to the extent of the costs, and we were going to exceed those cost guardrails. I won't go into the details of that, but ultimately what they were saying is your waiver's going to fail here. So we went through an exhaustive process to work with Health and Human Services, with the HSCRC, or Health Services Cost Review Commission, that Mr. Murray led at one point, to help define a new waiver. That happened in mid-2014, and it sought to fix some of the issues of the first waiver, as Mr. Murray mentioned. It was great that in an all-payer system where Medicare, Medicaid, all the commercial payers were in, everybody paid the same. And so you knew what you were dealing with, both as a hospital administrator and as a managed care company or a state that was managing the waiver. We knew what we were dealing with. That's a concern I have about this bill. Without Medicare and Medicaid in, that it would be very, very difficult to do that without an all-payer system. The problem with it is it still incented volume. So it incented you to admit as many people as you can, do as many procedures as you can. Your revenue still came in based on volume. There were quality measures in place, but they were minor, small penalties for not doing well, and frankly, they were pretty easy to meet. So it was really kind of just the old system, but with more set reimbursement. In 2014, we reset that. I was privileged to serve on the Finance Committee of the Maryland Hospital Association that helped recommend some changes for the new waiver. And as Mr. Murray stated, it did institute a global payment system. So you basically get X amount of dollars at the beginning of the year. This is an oversimplification, forgive me for that, but this is in essence how it works. You get X amount of dollars, and you take care of whoever comes through your door for that amount of money. Your incentive is to take really good care of people so they don't need to keep coming back and they don't need readmissions and new procedures. Part of the problem of that system that I would hope would be addressed over time in Maryland, physicians are not in the system. It's only hospitals, no outpatient surgery centers, no physicians. So they're still incented to do volume, while the hospital is incented to take care of the health and well-being of the people in the community. The other problem is there's nothing in the system reimbursement-wise for recapitalization of aging facilities. And also, you don't know who your defined population is, so it's very difficult to work with that population to improve their health status to prevent cost, because you don't know who they are unless they're your regulars. So in summary, I'm perplexed about why this bill would be proposing that we take part of a rate-setting system that was old, became outdated, was successful for many years, but was ultimately unsuccessful, when it doesn't even include all of the payers. And Oregon is already more progressive than this bill allows for. We are already looking at paying for value and quality and health outcomes through our CCOs and moving that direction faster than much of the rest of the country. I would hate to see us move backward and saying we're again going to start paying on a per-click basis for doing as much volume as we possibly can. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Parr.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name for the record is James Parr. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Salem Health Hospitals and Clinics. We operate Salem Hospital here in the state capital, and we have a critical access hospital out in Dallas, Oregon, along with a medical group of specialty and primary care providers. Given the hour, and there's only so much healthcare talk one person can take and retain their sanity, I'll boil my observations on the bill just to three key areas. I think the first area I'll term under transformation and innovation. The bill is very focused on and really solidifies and codifies a fee-for-service reimbursement methodology, which has really led us to where we are today and what Joyce talked about in terms of that incentive for more volume across the whole spectrum of healthcare. What we're seeing now, particularly in the last few years here in Oregon, and this ties in with the work that the CCOs are doing, is now starting to change that methodology where you're paying for outcomes. So moving away from fee-for-service and moving towards what is properly comes under the terms population health. So how are we paying for? So we have money at risk, for example, with our contracts, including with Medicare and with Medicaid, for what is your readmission rates? What is your infection rate? What is the patient experience when they come to the emergency room? And we think that's appropriate. We are now moving into avenues where you're being paid very similar to the OHA global budget, a set amount of money to manage a population, which dramatically changes your incentive for what care is delivered in a good way. So again, paying for those outcomes. This bill doesn't contemplate the continuation of that innovation because it still has its foot back in that fee-for-service environment. Now, that's one observation. Second observation is we clearly, the last 3 years have been a time of dramatic change for healthcare, and I think the next 2 years have a huge amount of uncertainty. Last 3 years, I think we've all been challenged to meet the demand for healthcare, the good demand for health that's come as a result of the Affordable Care Act and the number of Oregonians that now have coverage has placed a lot of work on the system to be able to meet those patient needs. And at Salem Health, we've definitely seen an increase in that volume, which then goes on to how our facilities going to keep pace with that demand. They need a place to come, they need a bed to be in, and we've seen that volume increase. The next 2 years with the change in administration and what's going to happen with the potential repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act is another period of great uncertainty. I see this bill adding to further uncertainty as it starts to delve into that reimbursement methodology, but only a portion of it, not the full width, including Medicare and Medicaid. And finally, my final comment would be regarding the charges on the bill. Again, this bill is very much focused on what is the charge that drops on the bill. And as others have mentioned, nobody pays that full charge on the bill. The majority of payers now are using a Medicare methodology, which is really uses a different basis for determining that payment. Medicare and Medicaid use that. Many of our commercial payers, for those under 65, not on Medicaid, also use that same methodology. So if we move around the charge master and the amount on the bill, it's going to have little to no impact on the actual net amount that's paid. One thing I would point out is that also falls and carries through to those that qualify for charity care. At Salem Health, if you are up to 300% of the federal poverty level, then your bill is reduced to zero. Again, this bill doesn't change that fact, and we're pleased that charity care policy is in place for our patients. So those are my brief comments.
Okay, we have time for a couple of questions. Representative Katie Geyer.
Thank you. Well, I was originally going to ask about what you thought about the West Virginia model, too. But I also like the idea of a global payment. I think the thing about setting ceiling prices that help protect against inflationary factors and setting floor so that small hospitals, perhaps rural hospitals, aren't at the whims of insurance companies that are negotiating too low. But thinking about Repnosis example of some hospitals making a lot and some actually losing money. That was one of the pieces that was appealing to me when I read the report, and I'm curious in the global payment system how we might protect from the inflationary factors on the high end and then hospitals not being in a strong negotiating position to get reimbursed, whatever the system of reimbursement, whether it's global payment versus...
We can capitate everything would be the ideal solution in my mind. Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair. I think for me, I'm just curious, when you begin to cap, are you looking at all of the other factors? I know Representative Buehler brought up cost for staffing. What about malpractice and all the other things that drive the cost of healthcare? You increase admissions and procedures. You put your docs at higher risk. Your malpractice goes up. I mean, at what point do you, I mean, how do we even begin to wrap our head? I mean, I don't, that's like way I'm trying to wrap my head around that piece.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to respond to Representative Hack's question, if I may.
You may.
Okay, so.
We're overtime,
I think,
remember.
I know. Just like Portland General Electric or Northwest Natural Gas or Pacific Power, those are complex industries with a lot going on. And it is the PUC's full-time job with their staff and the three commissioners to take into account some of those things and more to try to figure out how those utilities can provide service and make money and do it reasonably. And by the way, those workers are all organized. They all belong to unions. They all have good pensions. They make good benefits, including the executives. Okay? So, you know, that's part of what you figure out, right? And they look at that stuff based on what are the things we need to do to be able to operate the business, attract employees, and provide service. You know, so it can be done, right? But I think to the point of many of the speakers, right, it's not like there's a lot we'd have to set up to be able to do it properly. We could do it.
Let's let him have the last word. It's his bill. I'm going to close this hearing. Mr. Murray, I really want to thank you for being with us. It was very important to hear what you had to say today.
Sure, happy to be of help. Thank you for listening.
Stop and visit when you're in Oregon.
My sister lives in Silverton, actually.
Hospital that just got bought out by another.
We'll be glad to talk to you when you get here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2679 and apologize for the fact that we ran over a bit today. We are adjourned.
Great.
We are adjourned.
Great.
A bit today.